We do welcome you to our service today and hope that you benefit by being here. It is our desire that everybody feel welcome. I tell you what, Albert, I'm just going to head. Let me just bail out.
There we go. I was going to move around today, but I'll be still. Our hope always is that people come here and feel welcome. We'd like for that to be the case. We know that sometimes that's not the case. And if you have suggestions for us about how we can do a better job of that, we'd certainly like to hear that. And there's information in the bulletin. My phone number and email is in there. If you have suggestions, please feel free to notify me about that. I'd love to know have your feedback. And also, if you have a spiritual need that really hasn't had an opportunity to be shared today, we'd love to know about that as well. So if it can be helpful there, we certainly would like to. There's an expression, I'm not going to put it up on the slide because I don't want to be too offensive here. There's the old expression that gets kind of bandied around, if mama ain't happy, ain't nobody happy. Now, some women find that kind of offensive. I don't really understand why, because really the testimony of that statement is, mama is the emotional center of the home. And really, mom is it's a pretty strong influence. Now some women actually like it. When they hear that, they go, that's right. Don't you forget, that's the way it's going to be, and that's the way it's going to go. If daddy ain't happy, you see the poster, the bumper sticker. If daddy ain't happy, nobody cares. Or the more extreme one, if daddy ain't happy, the murder rate goes up. And that's really kind of the radical ways that men kind of respond. They're either emotionally neutral or they're way over the top. My favorite one, though, is if mama ain't happy, ain't nobody happy. If grandma ain't happy, run. The reason I share those is we understand that our relationships affect a lot of parts of our lives. And when somebody that we're connected to isn't having a good day or isn't feeling well or isn't feeling right, then we know that carries over. And we start to feel that in our own lives. We feel that connection there. And you can even go into Scripture. I won't use it, but 1 Peter 3:7 talks about the fact that our relationships impact even our prayer life. And so our relationships not only impact us in a lot of ways, but they're involved in us spiritually and how we interact with each other spiritually as well. We live in a culture that is constantly trying to find new ways to improve relationships. And if you don't believe that, go over to Barnes & Noble and just note how many books there are about how to have an improved relationship in all kinds of situations. The reality is, though, the Bible has some incredibly great information about how to have improved relationships. You can go to some very... Jesus, of course, is the most simple of all. He says in Matthew chapter 7, verse 12, "So in everything, do to others what you would have them do to you." Do unto others. When you're trying to decide how to treat somebody, just treat them the way you'd like to be treated. And I've mentioned before, that's an incredibly simple axiom for getting along with virtually anyone. If you go to Philippians chapter 2, Paul gets a little more lengthy in describing this situation. He starts in verse 1 and says, "Therefore, if you have any encouragement from being united with Christ, if any comfort from his love, if any common sharing in the Spirit, if any tenderness and compassion," and those are things we all want to have, "then make my joy complete by being like-minded, having the same love, being one in spirit and of one mind. Do nothing out of selfish ambition or vain conceit. Rather, in humility, value others above yourself." Verse 4. "Not looking to your own interests, but each of you to the interest of others." And you look at that and you say, boy, how could I ever do that? It seems like a tall order. And then verse 5 is just critical there. "And your relationships with one another have the same mindset as Christ Jesus." Sometimes people say, well, how could I be like Jesus? I may not be able to follow all of the ideals that Jesus sets out, but we can have the mindset, or some translations would say the attitude of Jesus. That's how we get to that place. Those are useful pieces of instruction. But this morning, as we move forward in the book of James, I'd like to look at James chapter 1, verses 19 and 20. These are passages you've heard many, many, many times. But I'd like for you to think specifically this morning about how they would improve your personal relationships if you were to actively, aggressively apply these three simple things in your life. James chapter 1, verse 19. My dear brothers and sisters, take note of this. Everyone should be quick to listen, slow to speak, and slow to become angry, because human anger does not produce the righteousness that God desires. How simple is that? Is there anybody who can't do those three things? How much preparation does it take to do those? How much background information? How much training? Is it something you have to go to school for years in order to understand? No, it's about as simple as you can get. Listen more, talk less, and manage your anger. And if you really want to improve the relationships in your life, that's the foundational issue. That's the way to go. Put that with what Jesus already said about treating others the way you want to be treated. And then you take this very simple formula and roll that in on top of it. And if we actually did that, then our lives and our relationships could be dramatically improved. I'm not going to spend a long time with each of these, but just look at it briefly. You know, we're eager to listen. We're quick to listen. We're swift to listen. How much do we enjoy having a good listener in our lives? Usually, the person who's a good listener is pretty crowded. There are people who want to talk to them. We are blessed in this church family to have a number of people who are willing and skilled in this area. And I'm not talking about professional people. I'm talking about people who are really good listeners. They care about what other people think. They care about what other people are experiencing. And they're willing to subvert their own need to talk in order to listen. It's an incredible, incredible gift. What if I said, okay, I want to be a better listener. What would I start to do? Well, really, it's just a matter of motivation and discipline. The willingness to say, that's a role I'm going to fill, and the discipline to say, I'm not going to talk about myself. I'm going to let the other person talk about themselves. I can't tell you how many times I've sat with men who are saying, okay, I'm ready to listen. They're saying that to their spouse. They're saying that to their child. Or maybe they're saying that indirectly to an employer or to an employment situation. Okay, now I'm ready to listen. And the reality is, it's too late. There have been people who've been talking a long time, and they've shut their ears off totally to that. It's not till it becomes a crisis, an unworkable crisis, at the final stage of the crisis, where many men say, okay, I'm ready to listen now. And there's nothing that can be taken from that. It's a very sad moment. What about slowing down our speak? Anybody in here ever regretted slowing down and saying something? Now flip it over. You ever regretted saying something too quickly? I am guessing that all of us can say, boy, I wish I'd spent 5 more seconds, just 5 seconds, to think about it, to slow down just a little bit, because then I wouldn't regret this particular thing that I've said. It's so easy to do. And the third one, of course, slow to anger. The thing I hear more than anything else when this passage is, or this section of the passage is brought up, is, well, it doesn't say that you can't be angry. You're exactly right. It says slow to become angry. Doesn't say there's never a time when anger is isn't useful or beneficial. But it does clearly say that anger is dangerous. In the second part of that verse 20, human anger does not produce the righteousness that God desires. When you're angry, you can't fully do what God wants you to do. And then flip over to Ephesians chapter 4, verses 26 through 27. In your anger, do not sin. Do not let the sun go down while you are still angry. And do not give the devil a foothold. Three important things there. First of all, yeah, you can be angry, but you're going to be the most tempted to go over into the sin area when you are angry. So you have to be very careful. The second thing is you've got to retreat from it quickly. There's a time boundary here. Don't let the day end before you've resolved that anger. Because if you stay in that anger, the third part becomes accurate in the fact that you're giving the devil a foothold. The devil is establishing a beachhead in your life. He can play, he can manipulate, he can amplify that anger, and before long he has you saying and doing things that you certainly don't want to do. James says quite simply, increase the listening, reduce the talking, and manage the emotion. And there's incredible value in that. If we hadn't heard it before, I think a lot of us would go, wow, how brilliant, how effective that would be. This has got all kinds of incredible potential. One of the things that we do so wrong in the book of James is we try to intellectualize the book of James. That's what we're used to doing with a lot of biblical material, New Testament material. Well, what's the author's theological point here? Or what's the intellectual basis and foundation? And we're searching for all those things. And really, when you do that with the book of James, you kind of miss the point. Because this book is about application. We don't have to guess what the author is teaching us. All we need to do is apply what's being presented. Martin Luther referred to the book of James as an epistle of straw because it wasn't theologically as superior as he and others would have liked. There is a tremendous danger in intellectualizing instead of doing. We like to talk about it. We like to debate it. We like to try to decide whether this is really good advice or not, or maybe there's some advice that would be better, and we can have that argument on and on and on, and while we're doing that, we're not really changing our relationships. And this passage is exactly like that. I read a story about a man. He was kind of the grandpa in the neighborhood. All the kids liked him, and he liked all the kids, and one day he had put a new patio out in his backyard, and the concrete was fresh, and a couple of the kids from the neighborhood came by and took a stick, and they drew in the concrete, and they put a couple of pennies in there, and he went out there and saw it, and he was just so angry. And his wife said, well, I thought you loved the children. He said, well, I love the children in the abstract, not in the concrete. That's the way we can be about these kind of issues. Hey, yeah, this sounds good. That'd be great. That's real smart. Wow, what a wonderful concept. And then we go on and we just leave it there. We don't actually start to use it in our day-to-day lives. We don't actually start to say, I'm going to listen better today. I'm going to talk less today. I'm going to manage my anger more effectively today. Why is it that we're not successful sometimes when we really do try? You know, sometimes it's awfully hard because of the circumstances. You know, you could go and say this week you're committed that this is something I'm going to practice this week. And then tomorrow goes disastrously. There's all kinds of frustration. There's all kinds of disappointment. There's all kinds of extra stress. And at the end of the day, you find yourself, really, you didn't live your life any differently because of those things. I'll do better on Tuesday. And then the same kind of day happens. And we have this frustration over and over again. And then we get to the place where we're, you know, kind of ready to forgive ourselves because, boy, if you knew what my life was like, You'd understand why I'm not able to do this. Think again about who the audience is for this book. These refugees from Judea are being shared, or this information is being shared with them. Wonder if there's any frustration and disappointment in their lives. You know, you could easily start to look at a family. And the guy who used to be a pretty efficient and maybe even wealthy, had some material resources back when he lived in Jerusalem. And now he works for a guy that he wouldn't even have hired back in his old place. He spends a long, hard day at work. He comes home to a hovel. And his wife is doing the very best that she can to make that hovel a home. But he knows that the song is gone and the lilt in her eyes is not there anymore. He's worried about his children because his oldest child really wants to go to school. And they don't have the school options that they had back in Jerusalem. He's more worried even about his younger child because his younger child loves it here. They enjoy all their pagan friends. They're excited to be out of stuffy old Judea. He looks and he says, I don't have time to fool with this. I've got things to do. I've got important things to work on. And he might even get back to the place that we can sometimes do and say, I'm in survival mode. All I'm going to do is survive. And Satan says, okay, I can make this work. Now, don't misunderstand me. There is survival mode. And there are times when all we can do is hang on. But Satan knows that if he can outlast us, he can get to us. Survival mode can't be forever. It can't be for always. We've got to re-strengthen ourselves and move forward. And that's why James is writing to these people who are frustrated and really, really having difficulty in their lives, as the trials that we pointed out last week. If anybody can say, okay, I need to do this, it would certainly be this group. Difficult times impact our relationships. Difficult weeks, difficult months, difficult years. And those are the times when we decide that in spite of all the stress, in spite of all the frustration, I'm going to be a quick listener, slow talker, and an anger manager. I'm going to do those things anyway in spite of those circumstances. The application is the challenge. And it may be that we need to pray that God will give us the strength to do these three things. Probably right now, you can think of people you know who ignore this directive. Maybe they ignore one of the three things. And it was really interesting to me that as I did research for this lesson, that frequently there were people who would ignore one of the three. They weren't willing to take all three of them. They would point out two of them, but they weren't willing to do all three. And that varied depending on their perspective just a little bit. We have these relationships, and we get this sense that we have an unlimited number of chances. We have an unlimited number of opportunities to listen. We have an unlimited number of opportunities to slow down what we're going to say. We feel like we have so many opportunities with our spouse and with our children that, you know, if we're angry some of the time, then that's okay. But the reality is we don't know when those critical moments are there that are making things, deciding things for a long time forward. I think it all boils down to how much we love other people. Do I love you enough to listen to you? Do I love you enough to restrict what I say? Do I love you enough not to get angry? I was looking for a final story to use, and I had looked and looked all week, and I didn't really find anything that I liked. And then yesterday, Kevin Binkley sent me a story, and I looked at that last evening and went, yeah, I want to share that. It's a story of a six-year-old boy. He and his mom and dad have a 10-year-old wolfhound dog. And the dog is very ill, And they take it to the vet, and the vet says, I can't help the dog. We need to put him down. And so the family is there, and the vet tells the story, and he's just shocked by how placid and calm the little boy is. And the boy, I won't share all the details because I don't want to make you cry, but because you would if you hear all those details. But to sum it up, the boy handles it better than the mom or the dad. And after it's taken place, the mom and the dad are visiting with the vet, talking about the fact that why is it that our pets live such a shorter time than human beings? And so that frequently puts people in situations where they experience this kind of thing multiple times across their life. The little six-year-old boy says, I know the answer to that. You do? Why? Well, God sends us here to learn how to love and to be the right people. But dogs already know that. So they don't have to stay a very long time at all. And then the vet goes on to share all these ways we can improve our lives by imitating people in the pet community. It really comes down to love. I love you enough to listen to you. Do I love you enough to not have to say something? Do I love you enough to manage these difficult things that can produce so much anxiety in life? Think about it for just a second. This advice is roughly 2,000 years old. Is it relevant to today? It's almost staggering to think about how relevant it is for today. And the testimony of that to me is that this greater wisdom from the designer of the universe reaches out to us and says, here's how to get along, and here's how to have the best relationships. And it's a very simple formula that all of us can do. This morning, if there's something that needs to be different in your life, you may need to change your interactions. You may need to change your approach. You may need to change a number of things in the people that you're involved with in life. You may also need to change your relationship to God. And if that needs to be a part of how your situation improves, we'd love to assist you with that as we stand.